From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. In a moment, an FBI document and UFOs. Richard Dolan joins us. Then later on, it's called Life on Nubis, Machines Replacing Man. Here's what's happening. Well, some time ago, I had a special guest on the program, Michael Maloof, and he talked about EMPs. What could happen if an atomic weapon was detonated above the atmosphere, over the planet, specifically over the United States? Well, now, U.S. officials are quietly expressing concern that North Korea could use its space launch vehicle to explode a high-altitude nuclear device over the United States, creating an electromagnetic pulse that would destroy major portions of the U.S. electrical grid system as well as the nation's critical infrastructures. The concern is so great that the U.S. officials who watch North Korea closely are continually monitoring the status of the North Korean space launch vehicle, whose status could suggest a preemptive strike against the United States. They are aware of the three-stage missile that North Korea launched last December that also orbited a package of some type, which experts say could be a test to orbit a nuclear weapon that then would be deorbited on command anywhere over the United States and exploded at a high altitude, creating this EMP effect that we have talked about on this program before. This concern is in addition to North Korea's latest threats to strike targets in Hawaii, the continental U.S., as well as possible attacks against U.S. bases in South Korea and Japan. And the United States will not accept North Korea as a nuclear state, according to Secretary of State John Kerry. Kerry's comments follows reports that North Korea plans to restart a nuclear reactor that it shut down more than 5 years ago. I'm telling you, there's something going on here. We've been watching this for a few weeks, but the tensions are very, very high right now. The United Nations General Assembly has signed off on a very strange, sweeping, first-of-its-kind treaty to regulate the international arms trade, brushing aside worries from some U.S. gun rights activists that the pact could lead to a national firearms registry and disrupt the American gun market. The long-debated U.N. Arms Trade Treaty, that's what it's called, requires countries to regulate and control the export of weaponry such as battle tanks, combat vehicles, aircraft, and things like that. But American gun rights activists insist that the treaty is riddled with loopholes and that it could affect U.S. laws and markets later on. And Connecticut lawmakers announcing a deal on what they call some of the toughest gun laws in the country, proposed after that December mass shooting at a school there. Some of the highlights: ban sales of high-capacity ammunition magazines, background checks for private gun sales, new registry for existing magazines that carry 10 or more bullets, statewide dangerous weapon offender registry, immediate universal background checks for all firearm sales, an expansion of Connecticut's assault weapons ban. And also, lastly here, the NRA is suggesting arming teachers, if they want to be armed, in schools to help protect them. John Lott, author, of course, More Guns, Less Crime. John, all these stories that are out there with these guns, first of all, your reaction to the Connecticut proposals.
Well, we only have seen kind of newspaper and discussions about these things or statements at a press conference. They aren't actually going to release the bill until shortly before the vote tomorrow on this, kind of basically what they did in New York, too. So we'll be learning more about it. But it seems one thing is clear, and that is that there's going to be a lot of taxes that people are going to have to pay to own guns, whether it be taxes for these transfers or taxes to go and register everything from your magazines to many of the different types of guns that people are going to own. It's just going to be a lot more costly for people to go own guns in Connecticut, as it is in other states. I mean, there's one common feature with this kind of flood that we're seeing in many states, and that is it's going to cost hundreds of dollars more just to go through the filing fees and taxes to get the right to own a gun than it did, you know, just months ago.
Okay. Also, United Nations looks like they're trying to do something to control guns and weapons. A lot of people, gun activists in the United States, think, you know what, that's the next step. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, the treaty does explicitly address small arms. It addresses rifles and handguns. It's kind of nutty. What they're trying to do is stop rebel groups from getting guns in other countries by regulating private ownership of guns. That's not where rebel groups go and get their weapons. Rebel groups go and get their guns from governments.
That's right.
And, you know, then it's more of an excuse, I think, to go and justify setting up registration and licensing systems. I don't believe it's going to affect the United States because I just don't think the Senate in any time in the foreseeable future is going to ratify a treaty, but it will affect a lot of other countries. Canada, for example, they just got rid of their long gun registry in part because they could not point to one single crime that that costly program had been able to solve.
And aren't you always going to have someone like Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi arms dealer? Somebody's going to always go to him and he's always going to be able to find weapons for them.
Oh, I'm sure. But this is not your typical, you know, person, citizen that you have to be concerned about. Countries are going to spend a lot of money on something that's just going to take police away from time from things that work. You know, Hawaii back in 2000 was spending 50,000 hours worth of police time on registration and licensing rules that were there. I mean, just think how many crimes you could solve if you just let police do those traditional types of policies.
Yeah.
Instead, we're going to have people around the world off on these wild goose chases and on something that will just lower gun ownership rates. You know, in Massachusetts, they started this gun licensing and registration back in 98. In that year, there were 1.5 million registered gun owners in Massachusetts. Today, there's just a little over 200,000. And my guess is you're going to see a similar drop in these other states. And that's why I believe that they're trying to make it costly. Their bottom line is just to reduce gun ownership.
John, trained teachers with guns in schools. Will that work?
Well, I think so. The NRA actually isn't for that. They're willing to have staff members that are there. And they're still pushing mainly the idea of uniformed guards. I think uniformed guards are costly. And the problem with uniformed guards is that if you have a terrorist type attack, they're the first ones that are going to be, you know, picked out.
Oh, sure.
To go after.
No doubt.
And I would hope the NRA would begin to be a little bit more flexible on, you know, allowing more people to be able to go and carry in these places. Look, we have five states right now that allow everybody from teachers to staff to principals to carry in schools as well as parents that will visit. There's no problems that have occurred. You can't point to one single bad instance that's occurred with those permit holders. And prior to the federal law in 1995, that the so-called Gun-Free School Zone Act, there was no problems in any of the right to carry states that allowed carrying at that time. And so, you know, but on the other hand, we see, as you and I have talked about before, these killers consciously try to pick places where they know victims aren't going to be able to defend themselves.
Well, of course. You know, if I were a criminal, I would go to a state that had very strict gun laws.
Right.
Well,
you know, Connecticut, up until 95, with the federal law, allowed people to carry guns on school property. You know, and one thing that they found out is this killer, who I hate to mention the name in Connecticut, he put together a 4x7-foot spreadsheet where he was mapping out all the different multiple victim public shootings and the amount of media coverage.
Yeah.
And he was showing to himself that the more people killed, I mean, I don't know why he had to show this, but the more people killed, the more media coverage. And there's evidence that indicated he picked this school precisely because he thought it would be easy targets for him to kill as many people as possible. He was trying to match the Norway killer, who holds by far the record in terms of number of killings with a gun, 69 and 110 people wounded. But his goal was to try to achieve the type of international news coverage that the Norway killer had received.
All right, John, always thanks again. John Lott. His blog, of course, you'll find on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. President Barack Obama has unveiled a new initiative to map the brain. Speaking at the White House, he announced an initial $100 million investment to shed some light on how the brain works and provides insight into diseases such as Alzheimer's and epilepsy. President Obama said the initiatives like the Human Genome Project transform genetics. Now he wants to do the same thing with the brain. The project will be carried out by both public and private sector scientists. Samoa Air has become the first airline to start charging customers according to how much they weigh. The company is the first to bring in the controversial measurement that means overweight passengers pay more for their ticket. A statement from Samoa Air said, "We at Samoa Air are keeping airfares fair by charging our passengers only for what they weigh." When booking online, customers are asked to enter their details, including the estimated weight of the passenger and their baggage. Bill Spillane spent 32 years as a combat-ready fighter pilot in the U.S., and he flew international flights for Pan Am and the United Airlines. Bill is going to be with us, by the way, when we talk about the fare tax in a few weeks. But, Bill, this, what do you think of this story, charging people because they weigh too much?
Well, George, I've flown to and through Samoa and Fiji and the various South Pacific Islands many times. And those wonderful, wonderful people, they make some great football players, by the way, are very, very large.
Yes, they are.
I'm not kidding you. They're very large. And I cannot blame that airline for doing something that's simple economics, because they weigh as much as two people. Consequently, fuel burn is based on weight of the airplane and so on. So I think it's perhaps overdue for them.
So you don't think that we are, picking on people who are relatively obese?
No. They're just naturally big. They're big all over. They're not obese necessarily, but they're just huge people.
Would that work here in the United States, Bill? I mean, if an airline, American, United, Southwest, any of them, if they started doing that, would there be an uproar?
Well, there would be an uproar, but people complain about all the fees and so forth, when in reality, if people are getting, let's say, free drinks and you just don't happen to imbibe, well, you're paying for their free drinks or anything like that. So when the airlines cut way back on their services and then charge for additional items, look, I'm a passenger too, and I like freebies like anybody else, but it's just simple economics, and you get the lowest fare possible if you're not taking the extras. And if you do take the extras, well, it costs you a few bucks.
So as a pilot, though, you're saying, hey, charge them extra if they weigh too much.
Charge them based on what they weigh. Now, the fact is, these people are so big, they usually take up two seats also. I'm surprised that wasn't in the news release.
That is amazing. Yeah, they do sometimes. Bill, I'll see you soon as we talk about the fare tax, okay?
Thanks, George.
That's Bill Spillane. Well, that's it. That's what Samoa Air is starting to do. They're charging passengers by how much they weigh. Now, in Saudi Arabia, they've got what they call religious police, and they are now saying that women can ride bikes in parks and recreational areas, but they have to be accompanied by a male relative, and they still must be dressed in their full Islamic head-to-toe garb before they'd be allowed to ride a bicycle or a motorcycle. Saudi Arabia also bans women from driving still. A poll by the Public Policy Polling says that 4% of the registered voters say that lizard people control our societies. Thought you'd want to know that. Story that we've had on for some time, a one-page internal 63-year-old memo about a UFO report involving three flying saucers and alien bodies recovered in New Mexico, making the rounds again. It all started with a story that the FBI itself released. In a moment, for the next couple hours, Richard Dolan joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Richard Dolan, of course, considered by many to be the preeminent historian of the UFO phenomenon all over this planet. He's the author of a number of volumes of History, UFOs, and the National Security State, AD After Disclosure. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Richard, how are you, my friend?
Hi, George. I'm doing very well, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.
This document about the FBI head in the D.C. office, Guy Hodel, right. This is not an old story, is it? I mean, it's not a new story. It's been around for some time.
No, that's right. It's been circulating around. The document itself is data from 1950, but it's been known to us. It's been declassified since the late 1970s. So it's actually been in the public domain for about 35 years, believe it or not. It was found back then by Dr. Bruce Maccabee, mm-hmm. many researchers, of course, through one of his early Freedom of Information Act requests. And he pulled this document out of the FBI files along with many others. And, I mean, it's a really remarkable read. It's a very short document, and it just describes, you read it, and you're seeing in an FBI document flying saucers 50 feet in diameter, beings of bodies of human shape 3 feet tall, and you're thinking, wait, what is this all about?
And it's authentic, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes.
The real deal.
Absolutely authentic. Yeah, I mean, there's a real story here, and in fact, the document itself, I think, you know, it's gotten a lot of play just again recently, and a lot of these sources are coming out and saying, well, it's all a hoax, it's based on, or the FBI never investigated it, so it's really in a whole big nothing, and people only care because the FBI website, I mean, this document on the FBI's website, they have their own declassified documents there where anyone can look at, and this is by far and away the most looked at document on the entire website. Nearly 1 million views.
It's amazing.
Which just blows, like John Dillinger, not a chance. You know, this document is from March 22nd, 1950. And actually, if you mind, in 1 minute's time, I could read it. It's only 2.5 paragraphs.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think people really should. So it's dated March 22nd, 1950. It's to the director of the FBI. That's J. Edgar Hoover. Of course, this was standard for all the special agents. This one, special agent, was Guy Hotel, H-O-T-T-E-L, like hotel, but with an extra T, in the state of Washington. And the subject is flying saucers, information concerning. And it says the following information was furnished to special agent and then blacked out. And it says an investigator for the Air Forces. Remember, back then, they still used the phrase the Air Forces, not the Air Force. An investigator for the Air Forces stated that 3 so-called flying saucers had been recovered in New Mexico. They were described as being circular in shape with raised centers approximately 50 feet in diameter. Each one was occupied by 3 bodies of human shape, but only 3 feet tall, dressed in metallic cloth of a very fine texture. Each body was bandaged in a manner similar to the blackout suits used by speed flyers and test pilots. According to Mr. Blacked Out informant, the saucers were found in New Mexico due to the fact that the government has a very high-powered radar set up in that area, and it is believed the radar interferes with the controlling mechanics of the saucers. No further evaluation was attempted by Special Agent Blacked Out concerning the above. And that's really it. It's March 22nd, 1950.
Richard, why would the agent who took this report not want to follow up on it?
Yeah, good question. Well, a couple of things may have been going on here. First of all, this story was based on rumors that were then circulating around in the area and in the country, really. It's quite possible he just didn't see any easy way to follow up on it. I don't really know. I mean, the FBI's position is that we don't put any credence into it, and we lost interest in UFOs shortly after that and stopped all investigation.
Mm-hmm.
That we were backing away. When you really look at the record, this is not true, actually. What you find is that in 1950, J. Edgar Hoover had been interested in these flying saucers for several years already, and as a matter of fact, in 1950, the year of this memo, got very interested in, and as a result of this memo, said, what is the truth about these flying saucers? What's actually going on here? And he said, you know, the Air Force is telling me that there's nothing to this, but it sure looks like the Air Force does care.
And the buzz over Washington, D.C. occurred 2 years later, didn't it?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Regarding this memo, here's the background to it.
Now, hold on for one second, Richard. We're going to hit this break. I want to come right back with you, get more background into this incredible FBI UFO document. Absolutely a bizarre story. We're with Richard Dolan. Split show tonight, so he's with us for a couple hours, and his websites are all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Dolan with us. Richard, this memo that we're talking about, which was written in 1950, Roswell, of course, 1947, FBI went out of its way to say it is not talking about Roswell. So is this a different episode altogether?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. What this memo clearly is referring to is the alleged, whether real or not real, I'm starting to think real, crash of a UFO at Aztec, New Mexico on March 25th, 1948. So it's actually not far removed in time from the Roswell crash, which, we know happened in July of 1947. This is March of 48, less than 1 year later. The way that we often hear these UFO crashes portrayed, it's as if Roswell was the only crash of a UFO ever, of all time. And when you really start looking into the evidence, that this is not the case, not even by a long shot. The Aztec case was actually got a lot of publicity early on. As I was saying before the last break, there were a number of people sort of talking about this. This memo is based on a lecture that was given at Denver University in earlier in the month of March 1950 by a guy named Silas Newton, who, long story with him, but he was friends with a journalist named Frank Scully, who wrote one of the very first books on UFOs. It was called Behind the Flying Saucers.
That's right. Scully and Edwards, those people from that era, they were the best, weren't they?
They were fabulous. I have to agree. Frank Edwards was the first really major radio presence in the United States to talk a lot and seriously about the flying saucer phenomenon. And his career took a real hit for that as well, by the way. Frank Scully, from whom the character Dana Scully from The X-Files was named, was a journalist and a reporter basically out of Hollywood, but he got interested in this flying saucer story, was friends with Silas Newton, and Newton had other connections and that led him to this crash retrieval story. Scully ended up interviewing what he said were eight scientists, and he sort of gathered them together into one character in his book, which he called Dr. G, G-E-E. What basically happened is he wrote about these stories and this crash just east of Aztec, New Mexico, he said in his book, and 2 years later was absolutely torn to shreds in a magazine, True magazine, by a guy named J.P. Kahn. And what Kahn supposedly did was to expose the whole Aztec story as one big hoax. Scully got taken in by Silas Newton, who was supposedly some con man, and this other guy named Leo Gebauer, who was supposedly a con man. And forever after that, even to this day, you have UFO researchers saying, oh, well, Kahn proved that the whole thing was a hoax. Here, that's completely not true.
Maybe that's where we got the verbiage, you've been conned.
Well, guess what? Kahn was the con man in this whole thing, not Newton, not Gebauer, and certainly not Scully. What we learned, there's a book that just came out a couple of years ago by a very good friend of mine, actually husband and wife team, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, called The Aztec Incident.
Yeah.
And let me just tell you, this is a great book that the Ramseys did all of the homework on this, and in my opinion, and that of Stanton Friedman, who wrote the foreword, and a number of other researchers, serious researchers, the Ramseys have, as definitively as humanly possible, shown that the Aztec crash happened and that Kahn himself had a personal vendetta against Frank Scully. Why? Because Kahn wanted to write that very book. He wanted Scully to sell him the rights to the all the research of the Aztec crash, and when Scully wouldn't do it, Kahn, who was a bitter, vindictive sort of man,
went after him.
He sent requests to J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, accusing Scully of all of these things, saying, you got to investigate this guy. You have to investigate Silas Newton. And a number of court proceedings against Newton and Gebauer, I mean, were thrown out. There was no evidence. They finally got a conviction on them when they use this other con man, basically another snake oil salesman guy, who they were able to bring Newton and Gebauer to trial, and they had them convicted of some kind of fraud. And for that, Kahn used it in his article to say, well, they're just, shady oil men, shady shysters, con men, and all this.
Mm-hmm.
None of this really seems to have been true.
But destroyed their credibility.
Destroyed their credibility, destroyed the Aztec story, so that for decades after, you know, very serious research, like when Bruce McAbee uncovered this memo that does sort of refer to the story, and McAbee is very careful and meticulous, but he also did not accept that this was a legitimate case. He said, well, the memo's based on this hoax incident. But I don't really think that's true, and a number of other people don't think it's true. And really, I think the Ramseys did the legwork on this. I'm proud of this because I knew them almost a decade ago when they were when they met, actually. I was there when they met, and when Scott was already researching Aztec, and he really deserves all the credit for not giving up on this case. So the thing about the memo then is, you know, it's true. I mean, the memo itself really refers only to talk. It's not like genuine, confirmed inside military information here. I mean, that is absolutely the case. So when the FBI today says, well, it's really only an unconfirmed allegation, that's actually true. I mean, as far as this memo is concerned, it doesn't indicate that there was any FBI investigation. Doesn't look like there was any follow-up on this. And so from their point of view, they could just say, yeah, you know, who knows what it is. Other researchers say it's a hoax, so that's really all that we're going on. And they just let it go at that, and they're able to get away with that. In fact, when you really look into the history, if the FBI historians were actually doing their job, which they are not doing their job, they would be able to tell you the same things that I've just been telling you and that any other decent researcher could tell you, which is that not only is the Aztec crash gaining stronger and stronger support from genuine researchers who are actually doing homework, unlike the skeptical debunkers who never bothered to go out to the crash site, who never bothered to interview the actual witnesses who were there, which the Ramseys have done, which Linda Moulton Howe did years ago, by the way.
And sadly, they're all dying away, Richard, so I'm glad somebody was there to get them.
Exactly. Absolutely. So none of these skeptical arguments really hold water when you see the way Scott and Suzanne just picked them apart masterfully, beautifully. But what we also know, in addition to this very probable crash retrieval of a UFO with tiny little bodies, yes, crazy as it sounds, it looks like it happened. On top of that, what we now know is that within the FBI, and Hoover in particular, who ran the FBI, was quite interested in these flying saucers and was convinced that he was not getting straight answers out of the Air Force. And, you know, think of it from the FBI's point of view. This is a phenomenon that is over U.S. airspace. It is involving sensitive installations. This is a matter of the FBI's purview. Their concern is domestic security. And so if you've got this phenomenon happening, they have a very strong argument for saying, hey, we need to be investigating this. So the FBI was trying to get answers out of the Air Force, and Hoover was not convinced that he was. At this particular time, for example, the Air Force had been running a program called Grudge.
Project Grudge. That's right.
Now, there's a name for a program for an unbiased investigation of flying saucers, right? Project Grudge. So what they had said is, well, by the end of 1949, we closed down Project Grudge because we were getting no evidence that there was anything to this business whatsoever. Total, complete lie. We have document after document from 1949, 1950, showing exactly the opposite. And Hoover, not surprisingly, was getting the same idea here. You know, the intelligence was coming to him, and he's getting this idea that, hey, there's an airspace violation over here, and there's another one over there. What's actually going on here?
What's happened?
Hoover wanted his own answers. So when an FBI historian to this day says, well, we had no interest in that, that's absolutely untrue. They're either not doing their job or they're just not being honest. It's one or the other. Now, this is a very important matter to all of the U.S. military and intelligence agencies that we've been able to get any records from. They're all interested, and why wouldn't they be? I mean, obviously, they're going to be very interested when you've got objects being tracked and recorded. Here's something that I think listeners may really have forgotten about or may not know. All during this period, 1950, the spring of 1950, the Air Force was running a project which they called Twinkle, Project Twinkle. And the whole idea of this was to triangulate these UFOs. Basically, they were calling them green fireballs that were being seen over near Los Alamos and other sensitive places in the Southwest. And you had a lot of scientists in 1949, 1950, all the period of time of this particular Guy Hotel memo. And these scientists are thinking, you know what? These fireballs, they don't look like meteorites, and they seem like they're man-made.
And they hover, right?
Well, I don't know about hovering fireballs. Possibly that's true, George. I actually would need to check up on that. What they were definitely doing is flying in a low, steady, straight, way slower than meteorites.
Right.
This is the thing that made them very strange. And they seemed like they were intelligently moving in the sense of in this particular area, like they were very interested in this one area. So this was a very high-level concern. So in the spring of 1950, the Air Force set up something called Project Twinkle, where they were going to triangulate these objects. And the official story about Twinkle is that, nah, they never really got anything out of it, and they closed it up. That's also not true. That's also absolutely not true. And again, the researcher who had the goods on Twinkle was once again Dr. Bruce McAbee. We have records now from April 27, 1950, just 1 month after the Hotel memo, in which the Air Force triangulated right over the Holloman Range in New Mexico. I mean, listen to this. They tracked objects at an altitude of about 150,000 feet. 150,000 feet. That's twice the altitude, say, of the ultra-high U-2 spy craft, which wasn't even flying at this particular time. There was no man-made object in the world
that could do that
in 1950 that was at that altitude. None. And they got the size of these objects, which they said were approximately 30 feet in diameter. Pretty interesting size, I think. And they weren't able to track the exact speed, but they did say they were at high speed. So this was an absolute triangulation from Project Twinkle. The results of that particular one were buried and hidden and basically brushed away in the official report so that people did not know about this for almost 30 years later.
Well, Richard, let me ask you about these crashes. You know, the Roswell crashes, crashes at Aztec. I mean, they say that we had the sophisticated radar at the time and that it may interfere. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know. It's a good question, George. Honestly, I'm not a tech geek on radar myself. It's hard for me to know the details. But I have spoken to people who said that the radar of that time period was a little bit different than the radar that we typically use today. I don't know how true this is, but the idea being that it was, first of all, it was very, very strong. The radar beams were actually very intense, and that they were highly directed. They were so highly localized. So the idea being, and one hears this a lot in documents of the 1950s, actually, and in, I think, incredible sources of the 50s, that the radar did somehow interfere with the mechanism of these objects. Now, on the other hand, I have to agree with you. I mean, does this make any sense? You've got these would radar screw up with our fighters today?
I mean, and you know, they had to have traveled from long distances. I'm sure they knew how to bend space and time because their propulsion system definitely wasn't like ours is now.
Right.
So they had this incredible way of getting here. It just defies logic to me that all of a sudden they'd all start crashing like crazy.
Well, I agree with you, but I would want to keep in mind one thing here is that when we're getting these stories that are basically leaking out from the classified world, we all have to wonder how much of this is true and how much of this is not true. For example, the FBI memo that we're talking about here talks about three craft, each with three beings in them, 3 feet tall. Well, that's not the exact same story, for example, that Scully was getting relating to the Aztec crash, and that Scott and Suzanne Ramsey got on the Aztec crash. They said there were 16 bodies at Aztec, two in the front cockpit area, and then there were 14 others. So you get all of these variations. Where is the truth? Where is the untruth? Regarding the radar issue, is it possible that when someone's getting a debriefing on what was going on, that they themselves were not being given the full truth because maybe they did not have a particular need to know about that particular aspect of the phenomenon? All I'm doing is speculating. But we do know, though, that within the classified world, I mean, for example, if you and I were in the classified world, but you had a higher clearance than I did, you would be told one thing about that event. I would be told something else because I wouldn't have. So it's quite possible that when we're hearing these stories about the radar, maybe that's not the case. I mean, it might not be the case at all. Part of Scully's account, when I read over his book and the descriptions of the inside of these crafts, I mean, there was nothing digital that I could see. There were some very, like, fine pieces of mechanical equipment, which I'm thinking, okay, great, but where's the digital technology, guys? You know, you would think, right,
that there would be some of that. You're supposed to, yeah, way ahead.
But there's no, now, maybe there was, and that did not leak out. I mean, I don't, maybe we'll never know. But the thing is that there was some, I am convinced that there was something very, very important going on in terms of crash retrievals.
Well, do you think if this, with this memo that we're talking about tonight, that if this person was, you know, just perpetrating a hoax on Hoddle, and would he still write it up and send it to J. Edgar Hoover if the guy was just making it up?
I don't think so. And when you look at the tone of the memo itself, it's a very straightforward kind of memo. I mean, there's no attitude to hear by the agent. There's no sense that he's making a judgment one way or the other.
He's not editorializing at all.
No. And he believed that it was important enough to send on to the director of the FBI, who, after all, was a busy guy, right? And you're sending a memo on flying saucers. Of course, the FBI was doing a lot of investigation of these flying saucers at the time.
Well, and as you pointed out earlier, Hoover might have said to his agents, I want to know about these cases.
Indeed, he did.
You know, and you send them straight to me, folks.
Yeah, and you know, it went on like this throughout the rest of 1950. I don't have another memo that I'm aware of from later that year that deals with the crash retrieval. But there are a lot of FBI memos from later that year that deal with some very serious, I would say grave, violations of airspace of very sensitive places like Oak Ridge, the Oak Ridge nuclear
facility. Oh, that's right.
Laboratories.
Richard, when we come back, we're going to take some phone calls with you in our final hour with you. But I want you to talk about the occupants of these craft that crashed and see what you can tell us about that. I'm George Norrie. Richard Dolan with us. And we'll open up the phone lines next on Coast to Coast AM.